This is Cross Currents. I'm Kristen Kay. Emmy Award-winning journalists and New York Times bestselling authors John Donvan and Karen Zucker wrote In a Different Key, The Story of Autism, which is now being developed into a documentary. Donvan and Zucker speak to building community for those with autism. This is also the goal of local nonprofit Ascendigo Autism Services, led by President and CEO Peter Bell. Ascendigo, based in Carbondale, offers outdoor recreational options for kids and adults, a comprehensive life program for adults, and behavior therapies for children. John, Karen, and Peter joined me in the studio to talk about the picture for those living with autism today. Welcome, John and Karen and Peter. Thank you so much for taking the time. I have first a simple question with a complex answer. What is autism?
We understand that we don't really know what autism is. And one might even say we're not even sure that we all mean the same thing when we talk about the word autism. But there is an official kind of definition worked out by professionals in the field. And they update it every now and then. And it was last updated in 2013 and published in a book called The Diagnostic and Statistic Manual, which is a book published for use by the medical profession primarily and insurance industries and education systems to decide whether an individual deserves the label or not. And according to that label, autism is a series of deficits in areas of social interaction and communication. And as of 2013, there is also the idea that these traits can exhibit in a variety of intensities, so that somebody could be to have it in a sort of mild way and in a very profound way. Peter, would you agree with that? And Karen, that's what we're talking about when we say what's autism?
Yeah, and I think your first comment is we don't exactly know, but what we do know is that in most cases, it happens very early in life. It's a neurodevelopmental disorder, and it does primarily affect the brain. But there are many other systems that are also involved in people who have an autism diagnosis. But I think in the most traditional sense, it is a developmental disorder that happens very early in life. And as John said, the most significant deficits are in the form of social interaction, communication, and just these repetitive, restrictive types of behaviors.
And there's a strong sense that it has a very powerful genetic component as well.
Mm-hmm. So Karen and John, In a Different Key is the book that you co-wrote exploring the history of autism as well as kind of the picture of autism today. So what's your connection? What led you to collaborate on that?
I'm a mother of a 23-year-old who has autism, and John has a brother-in-law, a 50-year-old brother-in-law who has more severe autism, and we're both journalists at ABC News, and about 20 years ago, I decided I needed to do something when my son was diagnosed to try to make a difference in the world for him and for others, and we started reporting on autism back then, and then we decided we wanted to do something to be more everlasting, and we started writing the book about 7 years ago. And it took us much longer than we thought to finish. And after we did the book, we decided we should do a documentary based on the book because we wanted to reach outside of the autism community in a greater way and reach the mainstream community to educate them and to understand autism and people who are different.
Mm-hmm. And so, John, you have, clarify for me, a brother?
A brother-in-law. My wife's brother.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And he's an adult, so his diagnosis, the time of his diagnosis goes back more than 45 years. And that has something to do with us getting interested in the history of autism. I think most people today have at least heard the word. They may know people who identify as being on the spectrum or are identified as being on the spectrum. But 45 years ago, that wasn't the case at all. And we became interested in what changed during those 45 years so that suddenly this is a relatively recognized word and concept and thing, and what happened during those 45 years and what caused that change. And it turns out we didn't know that when we started writing the book. It's a far deeper story than we expected. That's why it took 7 years. But there were some really, really really crazy twists and turns in the story of the diagnosis. And some of them are actually quite disturbing, but other ones are quite inspiring and hopeful. And it turns out to be a an astounding narrative. And so we decided, number one, to put the book together, and number two, to make a film out of it. Because as Karen said, our goal is to reach the people who don't think they have a connection to autism. We refer to that as the wider community, and sometimes we joke that those are the civilians in this story. That they're, but our argument is that even the civilians have a very powerful role in the experience of people who are on the spectrum, because if a community is warm and embracing, that can make life great for somebody who is on the spectrum. If a community is rejecting and isolating, which is what the case was 45 years ago, that can make life hell for a person on the spectrum and their families as well. And so we wrote the book to inspire the civilians to know that they have a part in the story. And that's what we see going on here in the Valley, is a little, or, you know, organizations like Ascendigo are the startups for that kind of thing that we want to see happen across the country, is communities coming around to recognizing that people on the spectrum are part of the fabric of the community, but that they need support in order to have the kinds of lives that we all aspire to have.
Part of what you talked about and what comes up in the book is the diagnosis. Like, how did that diagnosis of autism come to be? And what was the perception of autism before we had a name for it? John?
Autism came into focus as a diagnosis on its own only about 75, 80 years ago, late 1930s, early 1940s. Before that, were there people with autism? We think probably, definitely, there were people with autism who, if they were alive today, would have the label of autism. Before that, they were often seen as insane. That was a diagnosis given to them, schizophrenic, intellectually disabled, but they used much harsher terms in that period. They called them idiots. They said that they had idiocy, and that wasn't even meant as a slur. It was meant as it was a diagnostic label. Certainly, it sounds harsh and awful today. But beginning in the late 1930s, in two places, in Vienna and in Baltimore, two researchers started to use the word autistic about a group of kids' behaviors that they were seeing. And they were borrowing the term from another use. So autism was a term that had a completely different meaning, and it was a diagnosis, it was a diagnostic symptom of schizophrenia in which people would withdraw from society. Well, they began to use this adjective about these kids, but they were saying these kids showing these autistic traits, it's something else going on. It's they're too gifted, frankly, in a lot of cases. A lot of them were very, very smart and verbal. Very, very slowly they began to say, these kids who are acting in this autistic way, they have a different kind of thing. And out of this came the notion of autism. And initially, especially in the United States, kids who were given the label, and it was always kids, by the way, that's why I'm focusing on kids, although there are many, many, many autistic adults mm-hmm. today. But those studies and the work were done on kids. These kids were almost always kids who were very, very severely impaired, who could not function independently in life. And many of the first examples of kids described in medical literature as autistic ended up being institutionalized for life. And that becomes one of the big parts of our story, is that, you know, Karen can talk about this because she did a lot of the research. 50, 60 years ago, if a child had the diagnosis of autism, it meant that they were not going to be part of society, part of the community.
They were put away, they were institutionalized, and parents were told to forget about them, forget they ever existed. And in fact, the classic definition of autism, the original diagnosis, it was much more severe than we look at it today. And so if you look at classic autism, the spectrum was much smaller and much more challenging for parents and the children who had the diagnosis. And that still exists today, but we've just broadened the spectrum to such a extent that you know, the same person who has a PhD is getting a diagnosis with somebody who will need support and services their entire life.
Mm-hmm. And what was true in the past, too, is there was so much shame associated with the diagnosis. As Karen said, parents were literally told by doctors, by family counselors, by their lawyers, by priests, when they would say, what should we do? They would say, try to hide the fact that you have a kid with autism, put him away in an institution.
Forget you ever had them.
Forget. That's what they were told often.
Mm-hmm. You know, you've talked about parents, and my understanding is that parents were seen as the cause of autism. And I'm wondering if you can talk about how our understanding of the causes of autism have evolved. Peter?
So I'm going to add on, and then I'll probably address your question. So autism has been around officially for 75 years, and I oftentimes view it in 25-year segments. And the first 25 years was all about the age of denial, that this was real, that this was something that was biologically oriented. And to your point, you know, those first 25 to 30 years, the first thing that most doctors told families when they were told that they had a child with autism is that it was due to bad parenting, and specifically cold and unemotional mothers, and that's where the term refrigerator moms came to be. The next 25 years I call the age of defeat, which was, okay, we know autism's real, it's biological, but there's nothing that you can do to change the course of autism. And for the most part, people with autism are going to have it for the rest of their lives, and there's not a whole lot you could do to change the trajectory. We now live in the third 25 years, which I call the age of hope, which is, yes, autism can be a struggle, it can be a challenge, and it is a spectrum, and there are people who have varying degrees of disability and what have you. But for the most part, we do know, and I think the one thing that everyone can agree on is the earlier you can diagnose autism, the better the outcome is going to be, because you can intervene. You can treat autism. There are treatments that are available. Most of them are behavioral, but even still, there's a lot of things that you can do to improve the health of someone and also ultimately their outcome. So I think we're living in a more exciting time today than we have in the first 50 years of this movement. But there's still a lot we don't know. And, you know, as Karen alluded to, the range of diagnosis has broadened. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, we're all kind of scratching our heads a little bit and saying, well, what actually is autism? And you can look at a group of people that have autism, and there's probably a lot of different reasons why they ended up with this diagnosis. Again, John said there is a strong genetic component that's very well founded, but there's also a body of research that does suggest that the environment does play a role. It's not all genetics in the form of what we mostly think about, which is inherited genetics, but there's epigenetics, there's de novo mutations that can occur after conception, which really has nothing to do with inheritance. So, you know, there's a lot we don't know. The other thing that I think we've seen in the last really 15 to 20 years is a significant awareness and a significant investment in really understanding what autism is. The federal government is now spending several hundreds of millions of dollars a year to fund autism research so that we can hopefully come up with some answers so that we can, quite honestly, be able to minimize the oftentimes very debilitating aspects of autism. And there are some people who really embrace their autism, and it's a big part of who they are, and that's great. But there's also a number of people that really struggle through life, both from a health standpoint, but also just where they fit in and being able to have the kinds of opportunities that so many of us enjoy, but, you know, sometimes it's a real challenge for someone that's living with autism.
We also, what we haven't mentioned is we've really focused on the kids. And even though we haven't, we're not 100% there, we're so much further ahead. We know so much more about kids, and we know how to, when we do early intervention, that it can make an impact and make a difference. And there's schools and there's places for them to learn, and they can either be included or in different types of environments. But we really, really are still very, very, we haven't gotten very far in terms of adults. Mm-hmm. And we need to focus on adults, because all these kids grow up to become adults. Mm-hmm. And you know, what Ascendigo and people are in the Valley are doing is focusing on the entire spectrum of people with autism. So it's camps for kids, and it's adult programming and adult lives that they matter. Mm-hmm. And they don't just stay children forever.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Kristen Kay. My guests today are journalists and authors John Donvan and Karen Zucker, and Ascendigo Autism Services President and CEO Peter Bell. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment.
Peter, I want to talk about that a little bit. First of all, what obstacles do you see affecting adults with autism? And then what are some of Ascendigo's programs for adults with autism?
So I think as a society, we're still coming to grips with the fact that autism is not just a childhood disorder, that these kids do grow up, they become teenagers, they become adults. Some go off to college and, you know, they struggle to fit in and they may not have the supports that they need to be able to be successful. But I think the other thing is that as a society, we also need to recognize that people are all different and people with autism present in very different ways. And sometimes they're not necessarily easy and attractive, and people may not know how to approach an individual that has autism. So a lot of it comes down to education and awareness. And Ascendigo has been here in the Valley for almost 15 years now. We started as a camp for kids with autism. So most of our participants were coming here just on vacations with their families. But we knew we had something special. We knew we had a model that was meant to really help encourage people with autism to go into places that they otherwise would never be able to experience, whether that's skiing on a lake and wakeboarding or climbing a rock wall or going on a hike up in the mountains or horseback riding. These were all the, you know, kind of parts of our camp. And then we took that model and we started to apply it to real life. And so we have a very small life enrichment program for adults. We have five adults that are either living in one of our residential settings in Carbondale. We have a few people that are still at home with their families. But we're also looking to grow that. And we have spent the better part of, you know, almost a decade and a half really helping people understand what autism is so that when one of our participants goes to the local coffee shop or into a restaurant or into the grocery store, people know who they are. They're not afraid. They understand their differences, and they treat them in a way that is respectful. And they, you know, quite honestly, our goal is to make our participants as independent as possible. And if that means being able to navigate a town like Carbondale, where we're currently based, and they're able to cross the street and not have to worry about a car going too fast or someone slowing down and saying, you know, ooh, there's one of our, you know, special guys. You know, those are the kinds of things that really work well. And it's one of the reasons why we're here in the Roaring Fork Valley, and we call it our home because we feel that the sense of community is really working well. And we want to be able to take this model and to apply it in different other different areas,
and the history tells us that can happen, and that in small, because we have a great example of it, and that we discovered when we went back into the past. So the first child ever diagnosed with autism was born in 1933. Well, that kid is still alive today. He's an elderly man now, and he lives in the same little town in Mississippi where he grew up. And Karen and I found him and have spent time with him in that community. And it's astounding how what happened in that town in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, and ever since is exactly what Peter is working at building here in Ascendigo, is working at building here in the Valley, because it happened in Mississippi. Karen, when we first went down there, we just got a jolt in the way in which they told us that this guy was part of the fabric of their life.
He was theirs.
You immediately knew, because we wanted to be introduced to him, and friends and family said, "Well, we'll introduce you to his name is Donald Triplett, to Donald. But if you mess with him in any way, we will track you down and we will get you." Mm-hmm. And they literally said that, and so we knew immediately that this was a community that had cared about and protected this person, and we think so much of his success was based on the fact that the community just embraced him for who he was. And that's the goal of our film. That's the goal of Ascendigo. It's to say community is what it's all about. Mm-hmm. And it's not so hard to have the back of somebody who's different.
You spoke to the community. That can be really supportive. That sounds like a great example.
Yeah.
What's the other end of that experience? For families with someone with autism, where there isn't a community, where there isn't support?
So I'll answer it in the context of our summer camp. We have about 100 families who have children who come to our camp. Some are local, some come from other parts of Colorado, some come from all over the world. And so we see the whole gamut. We see the family who can drive into our parking lot, open the door, literally let their child out with their suitcase and wave goodbye and say, we'll be back in a week or two. We also have the family who has to physically help their child out of the car to make sure that they don't run off, to go to the nurse and hand over sometimes dozens of medications and dietary supplements and so forth, and to then go through the dietary issues that that child might have. We have some families who are still not ready to allow their child to be a residential camper with us, and so they take them home every day with them. So you see the gamut, and it's eye-opening, and your heart breaks for some of those families because, you know, many of them have never been able to leave their child in anyone else's care. The parents have never gone out to a movie. They've never gone out to a restaurant. It really is a very challenging condition for some families.
And to go to the opposite end of the extreme you were talking about, places where the community does not have support, the isolation can be crushing mm-hmm. for the families or an individual. And that, I think that's regardless of the degree of autism involved, because there could be, you know, somebody who is very capable of independence but has autistic traits, what used to be called Asperger's syndrome, somebody who can't has terrible time making friends, says the wrong thing at work and gets fired, walks out on the street, and maybe it's an individual who's not particularly good at taking care of, looks unkempt and talks to himself. Well, what's going to happen if that person walks into the wrong neighborhood? People are going to call the police. When police are going to come, and they're not going to understand that this is a person who has a disability, they're going to think the person's making trouble and is dangerous. That person can end up in jail.
Or on drugs because they're talking to themselves and they look a little off and they don't respond. A police officer can call their name and they don't answer.
So, in communities that don't understand, the consequences are very material and very real, leading to isolation, depression. It's very rough. And then there are the situations where Peter's talking about, where an entire family can feel isolated, where people don't want them coming to the local restaurant because of the way that their kid acts. And that was the rule 50 years ago. Those families were totally cut off from society. And very often, and before the internet, they were cut off from each other. And the isolation was crushing. So that's why, you know, Karen said it's not that hard to have the back of somebody who's different. But you just you need somebody to kind of tell you the story. And it's our conviction that almost everybody wants to be on the side of the good guys. They just don't know what they need to know. Mm-hmm. You know, we've seen there are a lot of police forces in the country now that have become very interested in being trained to recognize autism, because they don't. There's a story that we've been talking about lately where there was a kid who liked to open up car doors in Alaska. And the police saw him opening a car door. They stopped him. They asked him what he was doing. He got upset, so they pepper sprayed him in the eyes. And that police force did not want to be pepper spraying a disabled person in the eyes. They didn't understand. Since then, they've gotten, I believe, a lot of training because they want to do the right thing. It would be so much easier for them to understand. And that's the message of our book, that it's not that hard to be a supporter and to have the back of the person when you understand what's going on.
I think the stakes are really high for communities understanding and for people understanding. So let's talk a little bit about what Ascendico is doing to help educate us.
Sure. So very briefly, we're currently serving over 200 individuals here in the Valley. We do have our summer camp. We have a small adult program. We're also recently started a vocational program, and we're helping clients who either have autism or something close to that be able to gain meaningful employment at a variety of employers located throughout the Roaring Fork Valley. And then we also have an outreach program. And that outreach program is working individually with families. They're also working with schools. historically, this is a relatively remote location, and there have not been specialists or people who are experienced in working with individuals that have autism. And so families historically have had to go to the Front Range and to Denver and Boulder and so forth to get any kinds of services. Well, now they don't, because we're here and we're currently serving almost 20 families.
I mean, is that entire Western Slope area?
We're basically from Aspen down to Newcastle. We're starting to kind of inch our way up to the Vail area. But we're serving a need that is very important. So we're continuing to expand our footprint.
And Karen and John, I just want to end with you. So what's next on your crusade?
Well, the book did very well. We were stunned when it was named a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize.
That's a big deal.
But, you know, the reality is that a lot of people we know aren't going to read a book, but they will watch a film. And so we're aiming to finish completing this documentary that will be, maybe an hour and a half long and explain to the people who don't know much about autism about why the community aspect matters, why they are part of that community. So we're in the process of getting that done. We're still raising funds for that. So, I want to say if anybody wants to support by making a contribution, we're set up as a nonprofit, so it's tax deductible, and you can be part of the effort of helping us to get this film made. And then ultimately we're hoping, and we think very good chances for national broadcast of the film when it's done, probably this time next year. And our goal is, as with the book, to, as Karen often says, to change the world and teach everybody that they are part of the community and that being part of the solution is not that hard. It's just a question of attitude and understanding.
Mm-hmm. Lots of people ask, what can we do? And there's a lot that can be done. And, I think many people are starting to recognize that, for us to embrace certain segments of our population are really important, and to help them be all that they can be. People with autism have something to contribute. They have something to say. They have something to add to our way of life. And, I think it's important message that John and Karen have conveyed in both their book and I know that they will do in their upcoming film. It's the importance of a community, and we're living it here in the Roaring Fork Valley, and so we're just thrilled that they are here this weekend, and they're going to be sharing their story with many other people.
Well, Karen Zucker, John Dunban, best-selling authors, and
you.
Peter Bell, CEO of Ascendigo, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
You've been listening to Cross Currents. I'm Kristen Kay. Thanks to my guests today, John Dunban and Karen Zucker, authors of In a Different Key, The Story of Autism, and Ascendigo Autism Services President and CEO, Peter Bell. If you missed today's show, you can go to our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Cross Currents is a production of Aspen Public Radio.